Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, alongside the pandemic, COVID-19, an infodemic, rampant misinformation, is damaging and sometimes costing lives. We'll speak with the scholars studying these rumors, conspiracy theories, and falsehoods that are spreading through social media. And first, what is the role of psychological first aid in times of crisis? Lillian Ng explores ways to support psychological well-being with Carrie Gibson and Zubaida Mohammadi.
What is the role of psychological first aid in times of crisis? To explore this question, I am joined by Carrie Gibson, a clinical psychologist and researcher in trauma and youth mental health, and by Zubaida Mohammadi, who is an adult psychiatrist with a special interest in maternal mental health. Just want to acknowledge this profound time of disorientation and disruption. First of all, I might start by asking, what is psychological first aid?
Basically, when we think of psychological first aid, it came from a recognition that the kind of way that people respond to those situations immediately afterwards, in the immediate aftermath of a trauma, or indeed during the trauma, while it's happening, while people are dealing with these difficulties, that the way that people respond to that can be crucial for in influencing people's recovery. And we find that if people are able to respond in helpful ways, that actually people get over these situations much more easily. The analogy here would be general first aid, where somebody has an injury and somebody rushes up in the moment. They don't have a huge amount of equipment. They don't necessarily have extensive medical training, but they're able to do what is necessary in that moment to kind of settle the person, to deal with the medical emergencies, and to get them in touch with the support or other resources that they need to carry on. So we borrowed that analogy and we're kind of using it now for psychological issues. So that's really where it comes from. COVID-19 is something which is a sort of unfolding trauma, a kind of a crisis time, if you like, in which people are continuously being stressed by new demands, by the unknown, by threats to their health in an ongoing way. So all of these things are kind of trauma.
So this was introduced in the mid-20th century, where we were looking at people who had been exposed to a crisis or disaster. And then it was expanded to include disaster responders post 9/11. And the entire principle is aimed about first do no harm, but also about basically fostering adaptation in patients or people, and also about being able to offer some kind of care and formalizing good common sense at the end of the day. And it would be looking at activities that any sensible, caring human being would offer to someone else in a similar situation.
So just thinking about psychological first aid as one of a number of responses psychologically and socially for people, who can deliver it? Can it be learnt by anyone?
We can say that it can be learnt by anybody. It can be delivered by anybody. I think the first and foremost thing is to understand that there's many guidelines around psychological first aid, and they all have similar elements. And the elements around most of the guidelines are safety, calming, connectedness, self-efficacy, and hope. And what we want to say is that this does not need to be delivered by mental health professionals, but rather be looking at people who might be community responders, volunteers, clergymen, teachers. And I think what's far more important, even before we get there, is if you feel that you are capable of being able to deliver this, then you can do that. And the training can be offered online. There's various forms of training by the WHO, various Red Cross agencies as well.
A lot of people do this anyway. As you say, it's a kind of a common sense thing to do. I mean, it's the best form of common sense in the sense that it's sort of empathic and kind and thoughtful. But in many situations, it's the ordinary person, you know, it's, as you say, it's the teacher in the classroom. It's even the family member with their with their elderly aunt who's having to help out and kind of settle them in a frightening or crisis situation. And so this is not a kind of highly professional intervention, although it does have some kind of strong evidence behind it. It's really giving you a bit of a framework for just knowing what kinds of things might be helpful to say and do when somebody's in a state of distress. And it's not a set of absolute rules, but it's a kind of a guideline for how to be.
And one of those elements is safety. What are ways to help and promote a sense of psychological safety?
Firstly, safety from a psychological perspective. You want that person to feel that you are caring, that you are empathic, that you approach them with respect, respecting their dignity, but also about being culturally sensitive in that arena. Once you are there, you also have to think about how to maintain privacy and being able to ask, maybe not necessarily ask, but being able to approach certain aspects sensitively in terms of the trauma that's there. Simple things, introduce yourself. Let them know that you're just there to help. You may not necessarily need to talk. You do not need to pressure them to talk. It is just about being able to listen, maintain eye contact. I think, you know, a very humane thing is about offering to just hold someone's hand. And that is something that we cannot do in an environment like COVID, which makes it even more difficult to offer that empathy in that situation and that caring. And I think if you just be able to maintain that contact and show your caring and empathy, that grounds that person to be able to connect with you.
Yeah, so that safety originally came from the idea that if somebody were in a sort of a disaster situation, an earthquake, that you made sure that, you know, your very first priority is that they should be sitting somewhere safe where their life isn't in danger and your life isn't in danger. But an extrapolation of that, as Zubeda said, is really that feeling of psychological safety. And, you know, when you're doing face-to-face work with somebody who's in a trauma, we even try and get them into, you know, you might be in a very chaotic situation, but maybe you try and find a quiet corner where you can pull two chairs together and sit quietly, think about who can hear, think about, you know, whether there's a little bit of silence around you. It's not always possible. And of course, COVID is bringing all sorts of challenges for us here, because so much of this sense of connection and safety that we get from a connection with somebody who's speaking to us personally and cares about what we're going through. We used to do that face-to-face, giving somebody a cup of tea, taking their hand, you know, making sure they're sitting comfortably. And when you, as is often the case with COVID-19, you're having to work through digital communication as we are now. All our Zoom communication, or whether it's instant messaging or texting or whatever kind of digital communication you're using, there's still ways to kind of do some of that introductory stuff and make sure that people are feeling safe and comfortable. You can literally say things like, where are you sitting now? Is that an okay place for you to be sitting? Hi, I'm Kerry, you know, tell me about, you know, where you are at now, and you know, kind of do some of that initial joining that makes people safe. And people think when it's digital that you have to get straight into the resolution of something, like transmitting facts. Particularly, say, in email, for example, people forget all about the relational connection, but it's so important, and you can communicate that via digital media.
We spoke also about the element of calming. How can we help calm people in order to reduce their distress?
You want to be able to get the person to focus on the here and now. Sometimes it is about being able to say, what you're feeling is completely okay. It is okay to feel overwhelmed, anxious, uncertain of what's going on, or maybe a little bit confused. What's next? And sometimes even feeling a little bit numb and detached in the situation. Acknowledge those feelings. It's okay that that is happening. So first to be able to acknowledge that that's okay, that it's happening, and then to be able to say, all right, how now can I just connect and come back to being where I am here and now? And sometimes it's about saying to that person in a calm tone, making that eye contact, And simple things like focus on five things around you that's not distressing. Looking at grounding, even if it's placing your feet on the ground, and just being able to feel where you are in the here and now.
I think it's quite important not to provide false reassurance. So, you know, what Zubeda is saying is absolutely right here, you know, that it's about, it's kind of validating what the person is feeling. Like, yes, it is, you know, it is feeling overwhelming right now. Or this is a difficult situation to kind of tolerate. Rather than, you know, it's kind of often when we're faced with somebody in distress, we want to sort of rescue them. We want to make it better. And we want to come in and say, look, it's going to be all right. It'll be better soon. And say with COVID-19, we don't know exactly how it's going to play out. We don't know where things are. And so to say, yeah, it's really difficult to deal with this level of uncertainty. So you can bring some reassurance in, but it needs to be authentic reassurance, things that we can reassure about. Otherwise, it sort of becomes empty. A lot of people do find deep breathing, diaphragmatic breathing very helpful in calming them down, but you have to be pretty careful when you're meeting somebody for the first time. You don't know what that means to them. It can be quite frightening for people, for example, who are have physical health problems to breathe deeply, especially as you can imagine with some of the symptoms of COVID-19, breathing deeply may not always be the best thing for somebody in a state of distress. So I wouldn't jump in there straight away to kind of offer these sort of magic solutions. It might be better in that case to say to somebody, look, this helps some people. It's certainly not a, you know, an instant solution for everybody.
It might be a good time to talk about some caveats of psychological first aid, the notion that you're not that person's therapist, so you're not providing therapy. Do you want to elaborate on that?
I think that's important to understand that, firstly, you do not have to be a mental health trained professional to deliver psychological first aid. And you are not there to relive the events that have occurred. You're not there to process their emotions. You're not there to debrief them. So what you are there to do is to listen primarily. You're not there to pressure them to talk at all, and it is about being offering information, emotional care and support during a time of distress.
So we've been talking about some of the key sort of features of psychological first aid, and we've spoken about safety being tremendously important as a starting point, and then helping people feel calmer. Probably one of the most important things is to create a sense of connection with a person, where they introduce themselves, say who they are. Culturally, there might be things that you need to do there to make people feel more safe and comfortable for Māori and Pacifica, for example. Karakia might be helpful there. But also kind of then helping them to connect to people around them that can support them. So one of the very first questions I would be asking of somebody in a state of high distress is, who would you normally talk to about this? Are they around for you to talk to them? Is there a way that I could help put you in contact with them? So it's not even the professionals in the first instance that you want to put people in contact with. It's really the people that they love and that they often turn to. And those people can be more helpful sometimes than professional help in those early stages.
I'm just aware that there may be some people who don't speak very much about their emotions or in fact, avoid them. So how could we advise on plugging into someone's emotional state?
We all have an innate sense that pushes us towards empathy. And I'm just drawing on my perinatal training here. Rizalassi, I think, describes something called the mirror neuron system that is about our ability to read the emotions on other people, and that gives us an understanding of their internal state. And I think that if we can think about our own feelings in that perspective and tap into our feelings to be able to understand what somebody else is going through, that gives us that capacity for empathy. And that allows us to be able to talk to people and make that connection and to be able to say, I see what you're going through and I can feel it as well. And that's very important. And once again, it's about that connectedness, making that eye contact and being supportive and being genuine. That's what you're there to do. You're not there to make any false promises, don't commit to doing things that is not within your reach, but keep to what you can actually do in that situation.
And also just kind of being respectful of the way that people want to deal with something in that moment. So some people are very expressive and they want to talk about their emotions, and then, you know, then it's good to make a space for them to do that and to listen to what they want to say and let them know that you're hearing it.
So from a practical perspective, I think, you know, when you see the person, it is about understanding what are their current needs. And, you know, you need to ascertain what is it that you need in this moment. And it might be a simple thing like, I need to know where I'm going to live tonight. I need to be able to know what my financial situation is. Or I just may want to be able to contact my loved ones and let them know I'm safe, or finding out whether they are safe.
That also links to one of the other key features of a psychological first aid approach, which is really to sort of give people a sense of efficacy, which is a sense that they can do things, that they can reclaim control. One of the things that these traumatic or crisis situations do to us is they make us feel very powerless and helpless, which is one of the reasons why they're so frightening. And so we help people reclaim their own sense of being able to kind of do things. So in those examples Zubeda was giving about, you know, what somebody might want to do, like I need to let my family know I'm safe, I would say not, okay, I'll go and do that for you. But I might say, well, you know, how would you normally contact them? You know, would you need a phone? You know, here's a phone. Would you like to do that? I would let them do it, because that allows them to feel like they're taking charge of something again. And we also know that one of the things that really, really helps people in this kind of situation is helping other people. It gives you a sense of purpose and also that sense of, you know, efficacy that I was talking about. So to have people, you know, in those waiting times while they might be waiting to see whether their loved one is okay or where they are or what's happening, well, is there something you could do? You know, are there people around you that you could be supporting or helping? Could you be making tea for your family while you wait, or for other people in the waiting room? Is that something that would work for you? So just explore ways that people can act. And I mean, we see so much lovely stuff around that happening at the moment. Of course, they are helping their neighbours and all the people who need their help, but they're also helping themselves in quite powerful ways. So, you know, that's something to bear in mind too.
It's pretty clear that people do need support and resources to get back to some sort of normal. Can you suggest any supports that might be helpful to access?
The people that you probably want to talk to about how you're feeling in a crisis are the people you love and the people who are around you. So I really want to emphasize that there's so much value in talking to those people who know you, talking with them about what you're feeling, but sometimes just talking with them about anything gives you that sense of sort of connection that can help you through. So professional help is really when you're feeling that's not working for you, or you don't have those kinds of resources available for yourself. The risk when somebody's in crisis is that you want to throw all kinds of resources. When people in crisis, they literally can't take in that kind of information. So one simple piece of information, here's a number you can call. They will tell you what your options are. You know, they can get you to a mental health service. They can talk to you on the phone.
And also people have got a lot of needs with food, housing and finances and so forth. So accurate and timely information about those sorts of things would be helpful as well. Just wanted to ask you about this idea of boosting mental health literacy, because psychological first aid is but one way to do that. And as a public health tool, I suppose, but also in terms of thinking about the increasing awareness of our own emotional well-being and that of others, and how to foster that self-efficacy and hope that you mentioned.
It's very important, firstly, to let people know that what they're going through is normal. It will pass with time. Often it is with good family support, good community support, or support in general that allows you to get through. And I think the synonym of psychological first aid being community-based psychosocial support is very important. And I think that just taps into the model of well-being that we have, but that community support that is really so important. And I think that community support is what gives us that ability to identify our capabilities and to know that we can move forward and to be able to get through things.
There's been a big emphasis on sort of professionals as a source of support for people. And I'm, you know, I'm a clinical psychologist myself. Zubeda, you're a psychiatrist. Part of our job is to provide support to people in distress. But I think it's so important that we don't just professionalize that. That's not very helpful. I think one of the most important things I would want to say to people, I think, is that you actually have the power to kind of support people around you with your kindness, with your empathy, with your understanding. This is not rocket science. This is the stuff of ordinary, humane, interpersonal interaction. And we're asking people to use their own common sense with that rather than simply waiting for a professional to tell them what to do.
The aim of psychological first aid is to reduce that initial distress and then to foster that person's function in an adaptive way, which I think is a really empowering sort of message of hope that anyone can be present with someone.
The people doing the helping in the situation in COVID-19, but also around some of the other traumatic situations we've had to deal with in New Zealand, are also themselves subject to the same circumstances. So if you think our helpers are not outside of this stressful situation that the person being helped is in, and so this, we really have to also be mindful of the stress that all the helpers, whether they be formal helpers like us as professionals or informal helpers who take up that role in their communities and families, that the kind of stress that they're carrying for themselves, and to make sure that they also caring for themselves and being kind of gentle on themselves, not taking on too much.
With the COVID-19 pandemic, we're going to be facing this in so many ways. We are a shortage of psychiatrists, psychologists, mental health care professionals in general. It's a shortage throughout the world. So we want to be able to say that as a community, we can offer something. There's so many opportunities for us to be able to intervene and just offer some kind of support.
Well, thank you to you both, to Kerry Gibson and Zubeda Mahamidi, for helping me explore this question of the role of psychological first aid in times of crisis. And thank you to our audience for listening.
When we come back, the infodemic has worsened the effects of the novel coronavirus, COVID-19. We'll talk with the scholars who studied the misinformation on social media and discuss the costs of these mistruths. Stay with us. You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Misinformation is rampant about the novel coronavirus, COVID-19. In some cases, it has caused death, blindness, other emergency health issues, and widespread stigma and social ostracization. Our next guests study these rumors, conspiracy theories, partial truths, and full untruths. Saifal Islam is an academic at the University of New South Wales, and Holly Seal is a senior lecturer at the School of Public Health and Community Medicine and the program co-director of the Master of Infectious Diseases Intelligence course, also at the University of New South Wales in Australia. They are the co-authors of the study we're discussing today, COVID-19 Related Infodemic and Its Impact on Public Health, a Global Social Media Analysis. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have the two of you with us. What a fascinating study. Congratulations on it. I thought perhaps we should start with the findings and then go back into more specifics and into the methods. So if we were going to say what are the big takeaways, the consequences that are associated with this misinformation related to COVID, what would you say were those? Saif al-Islam?
Yes, thank you. Actually, we are tracking the misinformation and the stigma or conspiracy theories related to COVID-19 from the very beginning of the outbreak. I am in touch with outbreak investigation and I participated more than 50 outbreaks in my country back in Bangladesh. So I have some sort of experience that what kind of misinformation actually spread during the health emergencies. So based on that, we are keeping an eye on the notification of the outbreak when Dr. Lee informed about this new virus. And he was asked by the police that why are you spreading this false information? You are creating panic among the people. So since then, we were actually keeping our eyes and I talked to my supervisor that whether we can do something to track these things. And then we decided that, okay, let's start a surveillance on the media online platform to see. So whenever we started working on collecting the information and misinformation, rumors and other things, we have seen that, yes, the fact-checking agencies, they are the great source because they actually collecting a lot of misinformation and they're trying to debunk those information. So we are keep tracking on those fact-tracking agencies, as well as the leading newspapers. They are also highlighting some of the mostly circulated misinformation or the conspiracy theories. Then we try to understand that how they are going to impact. And then we notice that, yes, it has a devastating impact on human health. We didn't measure any psychological impact, and we know that there are a lot, but we couldn't track those because it was beyond our capacity. But we have seen that there are some deaths and morbidity, particularly in some countries in Asia. So that was the impact, and it is our little initiative to generate some evidence that, yes, the national and international health agencies, you should also focus on this topic to systematically document the impact. There are hundreds of publications on rumor, misinformation, stigma, but very few highlighted the real and direct impact of these on human health. So this is our little initiative to generate some evidence for them.
So can you talk us through some of those consequences? Like you noted in your study, there were deaths, there was blindness, there was hospitalization, there were some specific social consequences to doctors and other healthcare professionals. Can you talk about what kinds of misinformation were related to these and kind of give us a sense of how prevalent? Holly Seal.
To reiterate with what Seifel said, we all saw in the paper the comments around the conspiracy theories and, you know, those kind of suggestions that, you know, somehow this pandemic's arisen because of the introduction of 5G. We've seen kind of conspiracy theories in the past related to infectious disease outbreaks and so perhaps not so surprising to see those kind of messages emerge. Unfortunately, you know, there was also the stigma and again that played out in our media, played out in terms of hearing about the instances of people being verbally and physically abused, including healthcare workers, which was really concerning. You know, any sort of abuse related to stigma is concerning. But to think that people who were trying to work in our hospitals were being yelled at in the street or refused service, or we heard those, you know, in the early phase of the pandemic, they seemed to kind of shift away from that. But, you know, through this work, to kind of hear the volume of health impact related to the rumours, that is really the most concerning. The misinformation that has been circulating during this early phase of the pandemic around different so-called strategies to try and avoid getting the infection or to treat yourself if you thought you had the infection. Some fine, nothing's probably going to come of taking a few extra doses of vitamin C, but, you know, or maybe taking a bit of a herbal remedy. But the concern is it's what people also stopped doing during this time and reliance on misinformed strategies when maybe they were you know, avoiding going and seeing a doctor or avoiding going and getting a test because they thought they could treat themselves. And so we may dismiss something like taking vitamins as, you know, really nothing's going to come of it and it's not really important, but we actually miss what is the knock-on effect of those kind of belief in those rumours. But, you know, then of course the concern was the number of deaths. And we have spoken to other researchers in this field since this paper's been published. And they've said to us, how did you come to this number? And
What was the number? What were the numbers? Do you remember them?
The number reported was 800 deaths, but you know, we weren't able to document the number of hospitalizations beyond that and other health impacts. But you know, I think the number is somewhat arbitrary because even if there is half that number, it's still more than what we should be seeing for deaths associated with misinformed practices. Again, the important thing here is this isn't new, and we saw this when we encounter things like Ebola, Zika, you know, when any kind of SARS, MERS, when any of these kind of newly emerging infections come, of course, we will see, you know, these kind of rumours abound. And the same goes in 2009 with the pandemic. But the challenge is, if we knew this was coming, why didn't we have this action plan earlier to try and counteract this? And that is kind of, you know, my reflection on this now is why are we not taking these lessons, you know, for these past learnings and trying to apply them?
So I remember reading in the study that there were specific misinformation around remedies that were related to the deaths as well, and also to things like blindness and other types of hospitalizations. What were those types of misinformation bits?
Thank you. Actually, you know that there are some evidence that if we use alcohol-based hand sanitizer, it can kill the germ. So this evidence-based practice transformed that, okay, if you have the germ inside your body and if you drink alcohol or even hand sanitizer, it might kill the virus inside yourself. So that was the misinformation that actually contributed to these hundreds of deaths.
The problem is with that, we know who some of these rumours were coming from, and they were coming from very powerful people, not to be named. But, you know, the challenge with that is that kind of misinformation got beyond kind of what we were, so, you know, focused on in terms of Twitter and social media and other kind of outlets. And, you know, it was just in the media because it was being re-reported in different types of mass media channels because it was connected to someone very famous who said it.
Yeah. So I think you're talking about the President of the United States at the moment, Donald Trump, who had specifically named some faux remedies. And of course, he also spread the misinformation that the virus was nothing serious early on too, which I suspect has also been responsible for deaths and other types of consequences. I wonder, did you at all look at the misinformation around whether or not the virus was something serious early on? People saying you don't need masks, it's nothing more than a common cold or a flu. Was that one of the bits of misinformation you looked at?
Yes, actually, at the very beginning, what you said, that was the misinformation that it's nothing serious than the flu. So people don't need to worry. And there are other misinformation like in hot temperature, the virus can't survive. So you don't need to be worried. So these are the things that were really contributed to the mass transmission of the virus in the community. So those are the misperceptions that were circulating through the social media at the very beginning.
Were you able to trace more of the origins or like where did they originate these bits of misinformation?
It's really tough. It was beyond our capacity to find out the origin. When it has started circulating online and get more views, more like, more share, then it actually got the attention from the fact-checking agencies or national and international newspapers to focus on that topic, but couldn't identify the origin actually.
So you primarily looked at the fact-checking and the newspapers and the correcting of it, but you also did look at some of the social media. Which ones did you use?
We use Facebook and Twitter, and we looked for the topics. Actually, whenever we identify something, then we use those keywords to see that what is ongoing in those two platforms, and then we try to identify it. But it was not our objective to identify the origin, but maybe in our next work, we will focus on that. But I would like to inform you that there is an organization. It is an US-based organization. It's called AVAS, A-V-A-S-A. Yeah. And they just published a report maybe the day before yesterday. And they focused the origin, I mean, who are spreading most of the misinformation. And they said that there were around 4 billion views of misinformation last year.
Wow.
But it's related to health topics and other things. And we are going to collaborate with them to work on some of our future work. So maybe we'll be able to identify the origin and which media or the person who are or organization who are spreading more misinformation.
Your study was also international. You looked globally at this misinformation. You categorized the types of misinformation. I wonder if you could tell us where it was worst and what types, like which ones were conspiracy theories, which ones were based on something that might have a little bit of truth, but then, you know, were framed in a way that was not correct. Could you walk us through some of that?
Actually, the fact-checking agency, they made our work easy because all the information they actually corrected, they actually put the answer there, whether it is correct or whether it is false or misleading or it twisted. So actually, we followed their definition to categorize our information. You know that information is changing. At the very beginning, some people are saying that, yes, the virus can be airborne, and WHO said that no, it's not airborne. And then WHO again said that now we have more evidence that it is airborne. So something like that. Even there are some medicines that WHO or other international agencies are saying that, yes, this can work, and there are a lot of misinformation about that, but later they corrected this. So these are some examples that changing over time.
And then what about the conspiracy theories?
These conspiracy theories will get circulated round because, you know, to some degree, people will be outraged by them. They will touch a nerve, or people will think that they are ridiculous. You know, oh, let's have a bit of a laugh, you know, at some of the suggestions that are being put out there. But the challenge here is that what we don't know so well right now during this pandemic is the degree of belief and the degree that these, you know, maybe not the conspiracy theories, but the other strategy, you know, the other rumors have actually impacted. And that would be where we would need to go back to communities, do the actually talk with, you know, survey populations, do in-depth interviews or focus groups and actually try and tease out what were the so-called beliefs across this pandemic. What we always got to be careful here is if we start to talk about a rumor or a conspiracy theory and introduce it into a population that perhaps wasn't thinking about it, or, you know, it didn't really come on their radar as something important, you don't want to give it precedence that it doesn't have. And so I think that is that fine line, even in a research setting, that, you know, we've got to be mindful. And there's been some great work being done outside of the kind of the pandemic space, really to kind of look at how to counteract some of these conspiracy theories around something like vaccination in general. Mm. And there's some great work from a group in the UK that's been looking at trying to, they use the term inoculate, which when we think about vaccinations, quite, you know, close to home because you are trying to inoculate someone for a vaccine. But they're actually trying to inoculate them against the impact of a conspiracy theory. And it's worth delving into their work because how they're doing it is trying to utilize a past conspiracy theory that kind of, you know, is easy to break down as being a myth and being ridiculous, and actually getting people to understand how they can break it down as that. And so it may be something like if the conspiracy theory is around, you know, vaccines have been made to make Bill Gates rich, then you would go back and say, well, okay, who said that statement and what is their agenda? Where was that statement said? You know, was it said in an online forum? Well, is that legitimate? Is that where we get credible information from? What is the role of Bill Gates in this? And, you know, and so forth, and really breaking it down. And what they found is if they expose people to kind of a conspiracy theory that can really be debunked, that if you then expose them to future conspiracy theories, they're less likely to believe that or to be impacted in any way. And so I think there's early days in terms of how do you then take that kind of understanding to wider audiences, and how do you use those theories, you know, beyond the research setting. And that's how we need to approach these conspiracy theories. You know, when you look at them in a long line of the list that we put into the journal paper, you know, you'll look at them and go, oh, how ridiculous. But to other people, especially when, you know, at the moment, there's a lot of language around the introduction of this COVID vaccine and different suggestions coming out, that people may start to think, well, hang on, I'm putting one and one together and it's making two for me. Like, how am I missing something? Maybe this is real. Maybe this is a bigger agenda that I've missed. And that is where we've got some real danger now, and how we need to now quickly use these theories and these processes about trying to break down conspiracy theories is going to be critical. And I know the WHO has just done a large kind of virtual conference about the infodemic and about, you know, bringing together different experts around the world to try and think of some plans of attack for this. And that's really good to see. And really their strategies are at government levels and are about, you know, agencies working with online media groups and about ensuring that there is valid and reliable and trustworthy information available and so forth. So things are happening and it's good to see. I was criticised a little bit when I suggested that governments are working with the social media sites. Someone suggested, oh, how can we do that? You know, why did the social media sites want to, you know, take this challenge on? And, you know, it just brings them attention. But my understanding is Twitter and Facebook have been removing posts and they are labeling posts now. And this is new things that we haven't seen prior to this pandemic. So it's early days, but there is progress in a way that we haven't seen previously.
Yeah. So I'm just looking at your identification, the numbers, the quantification that you guys did. And it says 2,311 reports of rumors, stigma, and conspiracy theories in 25 languages from 87 countries. Can we get a little bit of detail on some of that?
Yes. As we mentioned that for a time, we were tracking all the informations that were also tracking by the fact-checking agencies and our everyday search on Facebook and Twitter using the, what is called the KPI key, or I forgot the exact name. There's a key that you need to track information on Twitter. So in this way, at the end of 4th of April, we identified this number after deleting the duplicates and actually we identified more, but there were some that we could not translate into English. That was our barrier. Even there were some languages, even we don't know what is the language that. So that were the difficulties or challenges. So in this way, we identified this number of reports.
So I suppose, I mean, the idea that you guys put forward that governments should be watching the social media and debunking regularly some of this misinformation becomes a little bit complicated when you have government leaders actually involved in the spreading of the rumors.
Yes, that's true. I mean, I just observed last week in my home country, in Bangladesh, the minister says that the virus will go automatically, so we may not need vaccine in our country. So you can see that the impact of this statement on the people of the country. So many people may not take vaccine if it is available. They may say that, oh no, the minister said that, the health minister said that the virus is going by its own, so we don't need to be careful about it.
And so where do we go from here, knowing the extent to which this material is getting spread and the extent to which people are believing it and the extent to which people are dying or being hospitalized or otherwise stigmatized as a result of the rumors? I just looked at your numbers again. It was 800 deaths, 5,876 hospital admissions, 60 cases of complete blindness.
And, you know, those numbers, they are picked from newspaper reports and from social media and from other sites. But, you know, they could represent an underrepresentation or they could be slightly over. But, you know, that's either way, you know, I think there's something to be said that we need to be getting on to this issue. And I think things are not going to improve. The amount of misinformation is only going to go up with the closer we get to this vaccine being rolled out. And already, you know, there's varying language around the vaccine and how it's being developed and about, you know, the variations in terms of, you know, Russia having one already available, whereas others are still going through clinical trials. And so this is going to be a very confusing space. And the danger here is that we don't want it to leak across to confidence in our normal vaccine programs as well. And so, you know, we've got to be able to get a handle very quickly and ensure that there is confidence and trust amongst the members of the public that if a vaccine does become available, that it has gone through the normal testing processes and that it's been, we know that the safety profile. And so we want to be able to meet any misinformation going out and be able to counteract it with our own messages in a way that, you know, reaches into hard to reach groups, and they will be the ones that may come out firing in this space.
You know, one of the other things I thought was interesting in your study related to where the conspiracy theories were most common, and you named China, Iran, Russia, the UK, and the United States. I wonder if you could speculate around why that is.
It's an interesting picture when you actually look at misinformation and who could actually believe in a myth or a conspiracy theory. Generally, you would tend to think it is people who are lower socioeconomic, lower levels of education. But actually, the trends can be the reverse, that highly educated people can actually start to buy into some of these myths and these rumors. It doesn't surprise me then that we do see a mix of countries. In each of these countries, of course, also there is rich political changes afoot. And so when we know about conspiracy theories, of course, with other things, is that the conspiracy theory that there may be multiple reasons why it's being spread, and one may just be to undermine the confidence in governments. And that's when we get to the issues about the use of bots and trolls, just, you know, circulating misinformation for the case of just wanting to get under the noses of the government or the power. And so when we look at those conspiracy theories, maybe we could actually break it down and have a look at whether some of those just buy into trying to undermine government.
Because it is interesting that some of those conspiracy theories that were spread by video and Facebook, etc., YouTube, etc., did feature doctors in them.
That is a trust thing. That's then a confidence thing that, you know, communities then are going to be questioning their capacity to make decisions and to believe the information coming from them. And so that is how elections are won and lost, by issues like that in the conspiracy theories going around. And so, again, we understand that somewhat now because I'm on Twitter. I can probably look through my people who are following me and probably find some odd cases in there of followers who probably don't look legit. But that's because I've read up a little bit about this and I've seen the photos of the warehouses with all the phones set up to send out these false rumours. And it's crazy to see that. I've spent some time now understanding this space and, you know, but not everybody's going to be in that same level of understanding. And so how do we bring the community across in this, I think is going to need some time and some careful work around doing that.
And finally, I was quite surprised at a couple of the rumors, like drinking cow urine as a remedy or camel urine spiked with lemon juice. What were some of the others that really stood out for you?
So there was a rumor that was circulating that the virus stays in your mouth or in your throat for 3-4 days and then it goes in your body. So if you gargle with boiled water and mix with ginger water, ginger paste or ginger, then it may kill the virus. So that was actually well circulated in many parts in South Asia. The drinking cow urine or using cow dung, it is still prevailing in India, and there are a lot of Facebook posts you can see that people are sharing that this is ongoing.
So. And that speaks to a strategy in terms of who are the trusted voices in the community. They are the local healers. They are the local doctors who work with these communities and in situations probably where, you know, there may not be access to other types of medications. Medications in general may be in short supply. They may be always expensive. And so what do we turn to in these situations? Remedies that have been passed down through generations. And so, you know, when we go forward and we try and look to new strategies, you know, we've got to make sure that we have a range of voices that are the storytellers and who are going to be the diffusers in these communities and ensure that we are working with them and we understand their concerns and their information needs and so forth. And we work with them to be able to get to a space where we can all ensure that safe and effective strategies are instead the ones circulating.
In closing, the other big misinformation thing was around the so-called China virus. And that was causing stigma around people of Asian origin. Did you find that was quite prevalent as well?
That was definitely played out in newspapers I know around the world. Again, where did that come from? That was because the president refused to stop using that language. And we saw it picked up in other places and other leaders. And that was a deliberate, you know, attempt to rattle China. And so that was inappropriate and unnecessary. But the problem is it then leaked into all of our newspapers. And so if people had misunderstandings about the reason why this virus originated and why it's now impacting people, of course they want to find someone to point the finger at. And that is going to be the challenge here. And, you know, we've got to just ensure that that language stays out of our newspapers, stays out of our daily vocab. And even in subtle ways, within my own circles, people have said to me and asked me about why are they still allowed to have wet markets? And why is food still allowed to be sold, live food allowed to be sold in markets? And this kind of misunderstanding that it's only happening in places like China and that's why this virus originated. And so it's a matter of us each taking a step to try and correct that, that, you know, to that particular person, I actually corrected them and said, well, here in Sydney, we actually have wet markets and we have live chickens sold at some markets. And so, you know, that is not anything different happening in that situation to what is happening here. And so, you know, it is about breaking that down and getting people to realize that it's just, we've got to make it familiar to ourselves and also to remind people that, you know, and I teach a beginner's class in infectious diseases. So this is, you know, one of my normal things that I lecture in, that infectious disease outbreaks start all around the world. And that kind of urban myth that used to kind of resonate that, you know, oh, they are only going to happen and emerge from Asia really needs to stop, because we saw pandemic flu come out of Mexico. We've had Hendra virus in the past come out of Australia. We've had viruses come out of the Middle East and so forth. And so we're not going to be able to give everybody an infectious disease 101 lesson, but equipping ourselves with some sort of information, you know, maybe help to just stop the stigma in its tracks.
Anything you'd like to add to that, Saiful?
I would like to add that, as Dr. Holly mentioned, there are some cultural practices that have been ongoing from generations. And if we intervene to stop that, it will not work. So there are a lot of interventions that have been taken by governments or local health agencies, but those against the cultural and social norms of those communities. So whenever we recommend something or any intervention, we also need to consider whether they are culturally acceptable or not. Like in some countries in Asia, as Dr. Holly mentioned, that people would like to slaughter or kill chicken in front of them. And if they're Muslim, they would like to pronounce the name of Allah or some verse from the Quran when killing the chicken. So if you say that, okay, there shouldn't be any white market, then people will do it hidden, and then it will actually worsen the situation. So we really need to consider all those things when recommending something.
Well, I want to thank you both for joining us here on the Scholar Circle and for doing the study. It's really important. Thank you so much for sharing it with us and explaining it to us.
Actually, this study was done in collaboration with Mahidol University and one university from Japan and my home institute, that is International Center for Diarrheal Disease Research Bangladesh, known as ICDDRB, and obviously UNSW. And my other co-authors, Dr. Abra Chuktai from UNSW, Dr. Salim Kaji from Japan, Mr. S.M. Mushid Hassan from Mahidol University, and my several colleagues from ICDDR.
Wonderful. Thank you all so much. It's been a great pleasure hosting you.
Thank you.
It's great. Thank you.
Saiful Islam is an academic at the University of New South Wales, and Holly Seal is a senior lecturer at the School of Public Health and Community Medicine and the program co-director of the Master of Infectious Diseases Intelligence course, also at the University of New South Wales in Australia. They are the co-authors of the study, COVID-19 Related Infodemic and Its Impact on Public Health, a Global Social Media Analysis. Thank you to our guests and to you for listening. The Scholar's Circle team includes Doug Becker and Lillian Ng, contributing hosts, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Tim Page and Mike Hurst, engineers and technical support. I'm Maria Armudian, and we'll see you next week.